Well, let's go to our very first session. It's on the theme of the festival. It's called, oh, how appropriate, Must Have Something to Hide. It was recorded last night at the Sydney Town Hall, and it's introduced by the writer and journalist, David Marr.
Now, tonight we're talking about what can and can't be said, about secrets, public and private, and about fresh ways we have of communicating and fresh demands there are for censorship and suppression. We're talking about war and terrorism and truth in the age of Twitter and WikiLeaks and enhanced interrogation. Now let me introduce the panel. To my left, until 15 years ago, Stella Rimmington was Director General of MI5, Britain's domestic spy service, its ASIO. She was the first known, and I emphasise the word known, the first known woman to head any intelligence agency in the world. She was a warrior in the last stages of the Cold War and a controversial figure at times in the Thatcher government's campaigns against the trade unions. But since going legit, she has published her memoirs, she's judged the Man Booker Prize, and written seven spy novels starring Liz Carlisle, who, as it happens, works for MI5. The latest of these novels is Riptide. Now, Jeff Jarvis is a famous American blogger, writer, and he's a podcast star and columnist. He's devoted to the new. He is a fan of social media, and he is scornful of the doom and gloom preaching by privacy advocates. He sees the internet as an open public space, and he wants it to stay that way. But thankfully, he hasn't abandoned the wonderful, old-fashioned way of communicating by book. His latest is Public Parts: How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. Next to him, in the centre, Heather Brook. Heather Brook is a journalist and a self-confessed nosy parker, who went to Britain as a young woman with rather North American ideas of what citizens had a right to know. She wrote a great book about Britain's rather late in the day Freedom of Information Act, and she showed how to use that legislation in her epic battles to help force the House of Commons to reveal MPs' expenses. Heather has since turned her attention to the world of hackers and whistleblowers and to WikiLeaks, and her latest book is The Revolution Will Be Digitized. Sitting next to her is Glenn Carl. Glenn spent 23 years in the spying game, analyzing international terrorism and international organized crime for the CIA. In late 2002, he was sent to interrogate a man believed to be a great prize in the war against terrorism, apparently Osama bin Laden's banker. He tells what happens after that in his book, The Interrogator, A CIA Agent's True Story. And as far from me as he can sit is Michael Kirby, who was a judge from childhood. I forget now how it happened, but he went straight from Fort Street to the bench. And he ended up on the High Court, where he was a stimulating and provocative presence for 13 years. He is a fine advocate of sensible causes, and his Who's Who entry goes on forever, as we hope he will too. And recently he published his memoir, Michael Kirby, A Private Life. Welcome to you all. Shamelessly, because I'm so fascinated by the subject, we're going to start with phone hacking. I want to talk about phone hacking, and I want to see the ways in which we might explain where the boundaries of private and public are drawn in the age when you can essentially hack into anybody's phone who has been silly enough, like me, not to change the PIN number. I'm very interested in how this thing finally blew, because it didn't at first. hacked in, you know, a couple of journalists, or a journalist and a private detective, hacked into the royal prince's telephones. They went to jail, no particular scandal. A few years went by, a few celebrities were hacked into, no particular scandal. And then, perhaps incorrectly, it was reported that the News of the World had hacked into the phone of a murdered schoolgirl, and an earthquake began, which is still continuing. Now, why, Stella? Why did it take that before the public sat up, took notice, and demanded that privacy be protected?
I think it took the Guardian newspaper, really, to actually draw attention to that particular angle on hacking. But quite frankly, I think that a large number of people had known that that sort of thing was going on for quite a long time. I mean, it was obviously very common in the newsroom of the News of the World, as we now know, and I guess it was quite common in other newsrooms as well. So it was one of those things that you get in British society anyway, where a lot of people kind of know things are going on, but it isn't convenient, really, for anybody to sort of make a fuss about it. But investigative journalism has been using all kinds of techniques, including hacking into people's phones, putting private investigators on to use kind of covert means to uncover aspects of people's private life. It's been going on forever. So I think it just took the Guardian, who thought, you know, maybe it was time to get at the tabloids, and particularly get at the Murdoch press, to begin to make an issue out of it.
But Heather, once the Guardian had done that, nevertheless, there was a particular quality about this accusation that seemed to really kind of clarify the issue for people. That this was a young girl, she was missing, she was murdered, in fact. This was not a celebrity, this was not a royal prince, this was a civilian. Do you think that's what it is that finally the community said, that's where the boundary's drawn?
Yeah, sure. I think that is why the public took notice. But I do have an issue about how much attention is being spent on this phone hacking case. There's 172 police officers investigating it right now. The fact is that journalists publish the material they get, and in this case, they obtained it illegally. That was a crime. It should have been investigated. It should have been prosecuted. It wasn't. And so for me, the real wrongdoing is with the police. Why didn't the police do their jobs? My bigger concern is that if we're talking about phone hacking, I mean, what News of the World did is small potatoes compared to what intelligence agencies are doing. I mean, they're hacking all of our phones, and they can do it all the time, in real time. And this is one of the things I write about in the book, is how increasingly our governments want to put interception backdoors into all of our communications, not just our phones, but our internet, our Skype traffic, everything. And yet we're not talking about this. So nobody seems to care. We're all talking about Rebecca Brooks. We know what they did, and they published the results of their surveillance. MI5 doesn't publish the result of their surveillance. Who are they accountable to?
Doesn't that Heather's comment establish that you've really started at the wrong end, David? You've started
not the first
in your
time
typical
he said
way.
That, yeah.
In your typical way, you've started with your obsessions about the journalistical profession, and you've concentrated on what journos do because that's what you're obsessed about. But you've got to put it all in a context. You've got to put it in a wider context. And we have it on the assurance of the editor of the Australian newspaper that this is not a problem in Australia. That... And what are you clapping for?
Glenn, the point that Heather makes, we may get to the editor of The Australian a little later in another context, but Glenn, the point that Heather makes is a good one. I mean, what those journalists were doing in a bumbling and amateur way, though effective, is exactly what you people do, and you do it all the time, and that is not considered a violation, but why not?
Well, it is, and it isn't the same thing, really. The issue of civil liberties and the protection of the public from the invasive eye and hands of the government is a very live one in the United States, and I'm sure elsewhere too. And there are active debates about what sort of controls can be put or must be put on intelligence services and official entities in doing this. The difference, however, is that the government does have a mandate to protect the public if it acts in accordance with law, and you can establish where the firewalls must be set to protect individual rights and yet to allow authorities to perform their mission too. But they are fundamentally different than a private entity that's just out to make money by exploiting people's scandals.
Jeff, why fundamentally different? Would you agree with that, that that's a fundamentally different action?
I think we're conflating two things here. One is that I'm not sure that the hacking is about privacy. I think the hacking, as Heather says, was about illegality and decency and a certain matter of cultural evil in the company to do it. But I think Heather's also right here that when you hear these days governments are trying to fix the internet, though I don't think it's broken, about privacy as well as piracy and other issues as well. But government fancies itself the best protector of privacy, but in fact it is the worst threat to privacy because government can use our information against us. It has the power of jail and law and taxation and so on. And I think that that's what we have to be aware of is, for example, in the United States, we have rights involving our mail, our physical mail, that our communication has to be opened only with warrant. Those protections have been brought over to our communications online. And so we're not talking at the level of principles. We're treating things differently because of different technology, and that's what's wrong.
Indeed, because I mean, all of the battles were fought over the intercepting of telephone calls. And Stella, there's a whole history, isn't there, of what MI5 can tap. But yet, all of those fights seem to have gone to the, just seem to have been ignored in the new technologies.
I'm not quite sure what you're saying here. If MI5 needs to intercept people's communications, it has to make a case related to national security, and it has to get a warrant in order to do it. So that is our protection, and that process can also be scrutinized by an external scrutineer. And so all these protections are built in the law. The issue now is that it is out of date, really, to assume that we only communicate by telephone and the mail.
Absolutely.
Most of us communicate by all sorts of other means, like Facebook and emails. And so the issue at present is extending those powers with all those protections to our use of the email, Facebook, or whatever it is. But that does not mean that MI5 or any other intelligence agency is going to scrutinize everybody's email. Can you imagine what size of organization, bigger than the KGB at its height, you would need to do that? And why the hell would you do it? The citizens at large are not presenting a threat to the security of the state. Certain people are. And the job of a security agency is to protect our civil liberties, to protect our freedoms in a democracy against those either who wish to overthrow our democracy and establish a totalitarian state or kill us all for their own reasons. And that's what intelligence agencies, security agencies in democracies do, and they need the tools that are up to date in order to be able to do it with all the protections that are built in through the law.
Glenn.
Yeah, it's one should always be concerned about whether a government can encroach inadvertently or consciously on civil liberties and individual rights. There's a robust debate about that all the time in the United States and I'm sure elsewhere too. But the facts are, even before the Patriot Act, before the events of 9/11 and since, that the federal authorities, the FBI in particular, and the CIA take their responsibility to obey the law, which is designed to protect individual rights, while allowing the authorities to do what Stella was just talking about, quite seriously. An example of how this is done, you must obtain, an FBI officer or a CIA officer must obtain a warrant to conduct a phone tap or tap into somebody's email account at all. Let's say the warrant is for me, and they are listening to my conversation. So long as I'm talking, literally, and I've seen this happen, I've participated in these operations, we will listen, and when someone else comes on the line for whom we do not have a warrant, we literally must turn the device off and wait 1 minute, and then we can turn it back on. Oh, still not the person for whom we have the authority. We have to turn it off. And those tests are, those procedures are subsequently verified by our superiors. So if we don't obey the spirit and the letter of the law, only to tap persons for whom we have warrants, we will be punished and prosecuted.
Glenn, we watched The Wire.
I never have.
You watched The Wire.
The warrantless wiretapping that the NSA did that was exposed by the New York Times, wasn't that different, though, in the sense that it wanted to get a pattern of communication to then see the anomalies in that communication, so that that's why they were listening to us all, to get that pattern of communication, not necessarily to listen to an individual who was targeted, but to see how we all operated and then find out what was unusual in that pattern.
What do you think about that, Jeff?
That's what we're negotiating right now. I mean, I'm an odd beast at this because I'm also was at the World Trade Center on 9/11 and I saw the exact impact of what happened there, most personally. And so there is a need for security in a society. The issue here is whether we can trust the government to act properly and with restraint and with controls and with checks on that or not. So I think there is a need to seek security, but there's a greater need for these controls and checks.
I think there's a real issue about one area of government going to another area of government, as Stella says, apparently is the case in the United Kingdom. Okay. Because normally the way we put checks is to require that the enthusiastic executive branch goes to somebody who is either a judge or an ex-judge, who will, as it were, look dispassionately at the matter, and that's what we do with telephonic interception. And the question is whether or not we have to extend that logic into the new media and to have somebody who's outside the enthusiasts. The problem of enthusiasts is that they get carried away. Is rendition, for example, in the United States, rendition of people, say, to Egypt, where they can be tortured to get information, is that specifically covered by U.S. law, Glenn, or not?
Oh, it is, yes. The CIA is...
Must be allowed, then.
Well, it's not allowed, and there are some... We have the assurances from the editor of The Australian.
This is the problem. I'm glad to hear that Americans also accept these assurances.
Glenn, please. I mean, you're amongst friends here. And we allowed the Americans to render to the Egyptians an Australian citizen. And then we provided the Egyptians with material to help them interrogate him. At the same time, we lied to his wife about where he was and lied to the public about where he was. So please, you are amongst friends. We're all cooperating. We're doing our bit here.
I always trust everybody. there's the law, there's the spirit, the letter, and the facts. The law... That's a true statement, actually. No, the law is clear that American officials, CIA, State Department, FBI, or so on, the United States may not hand an individual to a government that we believe will violate human rights, such as in torturing someone. So what happened in the 90s and then subsequent to 9/11, if we wanted to give someone to the Egyptians, and Michael Scheuer, a predecessor and colleague of mine, who was head of the Osama bin Laden branch in the 90s, has spoken about this, the authorities would write an affidavit saying, we have assurances from the Egyptians that they will abide by their international obligations to respect human rights.
They knew that was not an assurance that they should accept.
Well, I think the fact is, yes, that's correct.
Well,
but that was the maneuver done to hand someone to the Egyptians or the Syrians, say.
The problem with enthusiasts, they get carried away and they need scrutiny, and scrutiny by very practical, hard-nosed people who are experienced in the misuse of power. That's why Justice Hope did the big investigations here and laid down a very good regime in Australia, but the question is whether it's kept up to date. I'm not at all sure.
Well, that's why in the United Kingdom we also have these layers of scrutiny. You start off with a government minister, then you have a scrutineer who is a judge, And then you have a parliamentary oversight committee. And so we go on with these layers of scrutiny in order to avoid exactly what you say, people convincing one other person that what they're saying is correct.
I wouldn't say those layers are at all effective.
Well, how do you know that?
Because
as you make your comments.
Yeah, the main scrutineer of eavesdropping, for example, is the Commissioner of Interception, and his report is totally anodyne. I mean, there are no real figures.
Well, that's not actually true. You haven't got your facts right there, but we won't go into the details of precise
please.
Oversight
I would be interested to hear
mechanisms.
Them.
This sounds like a job for a judge.
He's desperate for work. This man desperate for work.
But there is a point, though, that we don't have any idea in Britain the volume of interception that goes on.
Nor do we
here. And people who have been incorrectly intercepted have no redress. They're never informed about it. Information is gathered on people. And who is scrutinizing it? It is other parts of the government. It's not the legal system. And that's where we're now starting to move in Britain also into secret trials. So not even the defendant when he goes into a trial.
We have not moved into secret trials. There is a green paper, which is a paper for discussion about whether in certain limited circumstances it might be.
But I think this is a tragedy.
You just got to be a bit accurate.
That we are giving up in the name of fighting against terrorism. We're giving up the things that make democracies great.
Follow RN on Twitter at Radio National. The hashtag is SWF2012. You're listening to a session called You Must Have Something to Hide, chaired by David Marr with Dame Stella Rimmington, Michael Kirby, Glenn Carl, Jeff Jarvis and Heather Brooke. Here's David Marr.
For all the highfalutin talk, panel, isn't the principal reason for state secrecy to cover mistakes? Heather.
Well, I'm going to wade in. I feel that national security is becoming the new word of God, that it can't be questioned, that you can go to a certain level of questioning authority, and then you come to this brick wall, which is national security. And if we're thinking about what is national security, who are we protecting? Are we protecting the political status quo? Are we protecting a bureaucratic fiefdom? Or are we protecting the general public? And I think it must be the general public. And in a democratic society, if the security services are to protect the general public, then they must in some way be answerable to the people. And that's not to say they can't keep certain things secret, but there has to be some form of oversight. And at present, I do sense that they are they're disrupted, as all politicians are, by the internet, by the way it's diffused out power. And the idea of free citizens communicating freely without the government knowing what they're up to scares them, frightens them. They're no longer the information gatekeepers.
Jeff.
Government has become secret by default and open by force, whether that force is Assange or a reporter or freedom of information. Government clearly must become the opposite, which is to say transparent by default and secret by necessity. And there are necessary secrets related first and foremost to citizens' privacy, related also to security, related to some matters of diplomacy. But the problem, and I think the WikiLeaks revelations revealed this, that the banality of secrecy, the overdoing of secrecy, government robbed itself of the credibility of being able to decide what should be secret when too much is secret. And that's the position we're in now. So we can keep trying to force the secrets out of government. And of course, part of the problem with WikiLeaks is that what you would hope it would lead to is more openness. And of course, it leads at first the reaction is to the opposite. It's more walls, more steel, more iron put around this. But in the long run, the internet will demand and cause openness. The lesson of WikiLeaks is that it's much harder to keep secrets. And if you're going to keep secrets that shouldn't be secret, you're going to lose your authority to do so.
I think the lesson of WikiLeaks was that the Americans didn't really know what secrecy was, because they had this huge database, which they were calling a secret database, which contained all kinds of stuff that clearly wasn't secret, and also was available to, as I understand it, thousands of people. Mm. You can't have a secure database or a secret database if you're going to make it available to all kinds of people, including a young man who'd only just joined the army or whatever,
a troubled youth,
who was going to put it all on a disk and take it home. So I think that's the lesson of WikiLeaks.
But the interesting thing is that really it's now quite a time since the WikiLeaks were revealed. And save for one or two instances, I saw a report in a News Limited paper last week saying that somebody in Iran may have been executed because of the WikiLeaks, that when you look at it, there hasn't really been a fallout. Okay, there's been some embarrassment and some private matter has been revealed, but it's really no big deal, isn't it?
Well,
isn't
but it helped cause the Tunisian revolution, which I think is a positive.
I think that gives dramatically too much credit to WikiLeaks to doing anything in the Arab world.
We're not talking about the motives, we're talking about the consequences
of the information.
I wouldn't attribute the revolution, the Arab Spring, to anything to do with WikiLeaks whatsoever, but I don't want to talk about that point for a second. You asked, and we touched on so many things in the last 90 seconds, about 12 different topics, 13 different ways.
We got hours, don't worry about that.
You know, I'll try to bring some coherence.
He'll bring it back.
Maybe I can bring some direction, or coherency to our comments.
He'll bring it back
to
a job for an old judge.
Glenn, I'm sorry.
Not so much of the old.
Yeah, your initial question was, what is the point of classification or secrecy? And does it serve to protect secrets or to avoid embarrassment?
Yeah.
And of course, in fact, it should be the former, and it is both. To classify something so as to avoid embarrassment for the government is not necessarily an illegitimate reason to classify something. There are a large number of facts and issues and thoughts that legitimately should be kept secret for the functioning of government. Clearly, a lot of things, we all have observed this in the government, will be classified by default unthinkingly, because that's simply how stuff is done, and also more consciously, because it would be in some way embarrassing. And it's an endless struggle to try to act rationally and not to do CYA classification. I don't think there, frankly, is a clean solution to this. This is something, it's like...
Well, getting caught a lot.
It's like vacuuming the apartment. You have to do it all the time. And that's just how it is. So that's what secrecy does for both things. But I think that the concerns that... we are losing our way. I've half lost what you said, although it was very pithy.
That's rarely said to me. Thank you very much. I think that you lose the authority to set secrecy when the secrets are revealed to be banal and, in fact, sometimes helpful. And so that's the issue, is that
over-classification of documents is a real problem. Yes. But I don't think that there is a clean solution to that. You have to continually
two of us might argue on the panel.
Now, if I could say something
about the Internet, may be a help to that, because the Internet does force openness in ways that institutions cannot grapple with right now.
I am agnostic on that. I don't
know. Isn't it a question of whether the First Amendment in the United States is going to permit regulation of the Internet in a way that damages the freedom which you protect for the rest of the world by the what to us seems a somewhat extreme and absolute position of protection of free expression under
your Constitution? I recommend free expression highly and the protection of it highly. We have Section 230 in the U.S. that, for example, protects a system provider from liability for the speech of others on their system so that we can have that speech, which I think is a wonderful thing. It's kind of the online equivalent of the First Amendment.
Yeah, but that's just a statute. That can be undone.
I realize that, but it also goes to the principle that speech is important. And yes, that's exactly what I hope for, is that the First Amendment will prevent these efforts.
That's going to be a very important battle, because though I personally do not support the extreme position of the First Amendment, I secretly hope that in this case it is going to stand to defend the free expression on the Internet for all of its faults and dangers. I think that is a very, very beneficial thing for freedom in our world.
But it's not just about things like this. It's also, if you look at the EU, Viviane Reding's proposed regulations on privacy in the EU, for example, argues for a right to be forgotten, which sounds quite nice. But if you and I have an interaction, then who owns that information? What's to be forgotten? If you say something should be forgotten, then that impinges upon my right to free speech. They've talked about a privacy by default, which would affect, if that were the law of the land, we'd never have Twitter, we'd never have Flickr. And these are things that aren't just about the...
Is there some way we can get rid of emails?
amen to that. So these are things that aren't just out of the First Amendment, they're also out of principles of law in other nations as well.
Glenn, I want to go back.
Yeah, I want to go back to the WikiLeaks for a second and say something that will apparently be contrarian for many. I've heard this quite a bit. It's almost become conventional wisdom. It's sort of a little bit of intellectual totalitarianism that one take as given that the WikiLeaks phenomenon was a positive event. And I find it appalling, frankly, and I'm glad that the man who leaked the stuff is going to jail. And if I could put Julian Assange in jail, I would do that too. No citizen gets to choose what the government can do with respect to the regulations and the procedures that we elaborate carefully and laboriously through the process of government on what should be classified and what shouldn't. No one can be a vigilante for justice, and no one can be a vigilante for information.
Are there to be no whistleblowers anymore? No leakers? No, I mean,
that's the basis of journalism.
That's how we move. That's how we discovered so much about the world.
No, I'm in favor of a free press, and leakers have a
what would you
a
think
sometimes
about, what do you think about the
system.
Pentagon Papers? Should they have been leaked?
There's a difference in in degree. Yes, there is a difference. Yes, there is. There is a difference in degree and quality. And I was talking about this the other day.
They were actually more highly classified. They were more highly classified documents than what was leaked in WikiLeaks.
So we're talking about what the issue is, and the Pentagon Papers were talking about a war with 60,000 Americans dead and 1 million Vietnamese dead because of actions that have been misrepresented by authorities. That is not the same thing as someone who says, I just think that everyone should know what's going on and that the government, by definition, any decision it takes with regard to classification is wrong, and so I will unilaterally share all these secrets.
That's how it
happens. It's not the same thing.
You pretend you're mouthing to a Lady Gaga tune, you download it onto a disc, you take it out, and the world discovers an enormous amount about itself.
About its own government.
About
the government
its own
of
governments.
The people. It's our government. I mean, it's our information.
And what we discovered about our government, because there was all the material there about what our officials were doing. You know, members of the opposition party trotting along to the American embassy to say, great, the refugee boats are back, more the better. We're trying to work out how to use them politically, but it's a great development. We discover that from WikiLeaks. But I wonder whether the problem with WikiLeaks, in the end, the problem with WikiLeaks, is that there's so much of it, Heather. You worked on the WikiLeaks stuff. How do we as the public deal with this enormous quantity of material?
I'm not a great fan of Julian Assange myself, having worked with him on the diplomatic cables. And I don't think that you should let that get in the way of what WikiLeaks as a concept is. And I think it must be supported as a concept, this idea of whistleblowers. By all means, charge the man if you think he committed a criminal offense. Well, then bring a charge. But if you don't,
in the open.
Julian Assange, I'm talking about in relation to...
I don't think he can charge him because he's not American. I don't know if you could do that or not.
So if what he's done and you think what he's done is illegal, then yeah, bring a charge. But if not, and I don't think it was illegal... in that sense. And I thought it was very disturbing the way parts of the American government reacted when the diplomatic cables were published. So I worked on the cables at The Guardian. And they were very disturbing for people in power because you're starting to publish things that have never been published before. You're really getting into the heart of power when you're publishing diplomatic cables and information about war. But I think that's part of what is so revolutionary about our time is that we are starting to get right in there with power as people. We're not accepting these little walled gardens where people in security services, people in the cabinet office, they can make decisions that affect all of us, that spend all of our money in taxes, and what we're just going to trust. We're going to trust you all. There can be some level of trust, but I think there has to be. I certainly, as a citizen, I want to know more about what's happening. I demand more. I can find out about all sorts of things on the internet. Why can I not find out about my own government?
I think for the same reasons that lawyers and clients have a privileged relationship, so can government officials in the conduct of their business have legitimate reason to maintain confidentiality of some of the work that they're doing.
That's not quite right. The privilege belongs to the client, not to the lawyer, and it is strictly controlled and has to be very relevant to the subject matter, whereas the whole point of WikiLeaks is that it's demonstrated that an awful lot of it is just gossip, mass material, stuff that should never have been classified. And the bottom line is how many real cases of actual damage to the vital interests of any government have been demonstrated by it, as distinct from letting people know the general nature of their government.
I wanted to say one other point.
Please.
At the same time that people in government say, isn't it terrible that these, you know, that this, we need to have this level of confidentiality, they're on a wholesale campaign to just strip all citizens of privacy. That's what we're talking about, the interception capabilities. We're talking about the way we're all under surveillance with cameras. And we're all made to be incredibly transparent to authority. And yet authority then demands to have that confidentiality.
Between us, does Britain really need all those CCTV cameras? I mean, just between us.
The CCTV cameras, as I understand it, have been put up by all sorts of authorities, certainly not by the security service. They have been put up by shopping centres. They've been put up by people who monitor the speed people are driving at. They've been put up by the people who run our stations to make sure people don't get on trains without tickets. So the trouble was that there was no regulation to prevent the world and his wife sticking up a CCTV camera for their own purposes. And that's how this great proliferation of cameras got there in the first place. And then all of a sudden, of course, we had dreadful events like the bombing of the London Underground, 7-7 as we call it.
And they turned out to be quite useful.
They turned out to be extremely useful. And on one of the cameras that had been put up by the railway company or the underground company, there were pictures of the people going off to do the bombing with the bombs on their back. So they then turned out to be useful. But, you know, that was a kind of happenstance in a way. It wasn't the security authorities who decided that everybody must be surveilled every minute, when they left their house. So that's how it happens in democracies. If you don't have regulations, people go and shove up cameras and then some disaster happens and they turn out to be quite useful. But it doesn't mean that the security authorities are watching now every single camera that exists all over the United Kingdom just in the hope that they might see somebody with a bomb on their back. They've got far more things to do and they have to be far more focused.
Now I'm going to change gear again because time is marching on. Three members of this panel have recently written their memoir. Well, not recently, but have over time written their memoirs. Glenn, of course, is here with his interrogative memoir. Michael Kirby at the far end, who happens to have a copy on his person. And Stella, who's written, who some years ago now, wrote her memoirs as well. Did it come as a shock to you to be vetted, to have your book vetted told what you couldn't publish?
Not at all. I knew what the rules were. And my book is not about the inner workings of every operation or whatever. You're thinking about Peter Wright, if I may say so, who's a different thing altogether. I wrote my book very carefully, and it is a book about my life primarily, not about, you know, the workings, as I said. The
and yet it was.
And I knew what the rules were. The rules were that anything I wrote that related to my work in the service, I had to have a submit for clearance, which I did.
And how did you go?
There was a silence in Whitehall when I submitted my book for clearance. They didn't know what to do. There was a kind of corporate gasp went round. And I heard nothing for about 2 months, and I wondered what on earth was going on, because I'd written this book very carefully. I knew what I should and shouldn't say. And then somebody within the clearance process put the uncleared manuscript in a brown paper envelope and sent it to the Sun newspaper, which is our most tabloid of tabloids. And they didn't know what to do with it, so they put it in another brown paper envelope and sent it back.
They didn't publish it?
No. Well, they couldn't because it was my copyright. So they sent it to number 10 Downing Street.
And Murdoch does care about copyright. We know that.
Yes.
I think was it pre-Murdoch? I can't remember when he bought the Sun. But anyway.
Ruined the punchline.
The Sun then.
And then after that, you know, there was a whole great press furore about me revealing all the nation's secrets, which, of course, I wasn't doing. And in the end, it was cleared, and I knocked out a few things that I was asked to change, and that was all.
But Glenn, your book was heavily redacted.
It was. 40% of my manuscript, 40,000 words of the initial 100,000 words, were taken out. The restrictions or the obligations for me are the same as we just heard, and they are legitimate to protect the legal mandate and obligation of the CIA's Publications Review Board is to protect sources and methods, and that's fine. We shouldn't be able to say that so-and-so is spying for the United States, or here's how you pick a lock, or things like that. That's all legitimate. Unfortunately, or not surprisingly, sources and methods, which sounds like a clear guideline, is a term of art, and it can be interpreted in different ways. So depending on the political winds and the administration in power at a given moment, it will be interpreted more restrictively or more expansively. And clearly, since I was writing about rendition, detention, interrogation, and possibly torture by American officials, this would be of concern and for a political administration and a governmental institution. So they were aggressive in trying to stop me from really writing anything too coherent, which I succeeded in doing. But they went well beyond, frankly, sources and methods. And I've told many people before, but it bears repeating. These are literally true examples. I quoted T.S. Eliot, and they censored that. And,
and that's on taste grounds.
Well, I responded. I told them that, you know, snobbery was a bad thing, and I applauded them for striking a blow against it, but that was not their job. I quoted Rudyard Kipling, and they censored that. At one point, I called a colleague a gibbering fool, and they censored that.
Glenn, the man that you were sent to interrogate, you called in the book Captus. What was his name?
I may not say.
Will you deny that he was Pasha Wazir?
I may not say.
That you interrogated him near Rabat?
I may not say.
And that you went with him to a CIA prison called the Salt Pit Prison in Afghanistan?
I went with the detainee, whom I call captives, to a facility I call Hotel California. I may say that, but I may not. May, I use the word may. Obviously, I can confirm or verify or clarify.
What is the point? What is the point of these denials? What
for
what,
me?
For you?
Legal
yes,
liability.
For, you.
For me, it's legal liability.
What liability do you face?
Well, my obligation is not to reveal sources or methods, and if the CIA decides in the formal process of publication review that certain statements or facts are not allowed, then I am enjoined legally from revealing them. So I will not confirm, deny, comment. At all on things that I may not do. So there are enterprising journalists, some of whom are competent and principled, who
have come to certain conclusions.
Have come to certain conclusions, and they are welcome to do so. I will defend their right to do that, but I may not comment on that.
Now, look, there is an immense debate that we haven't had tonight about privacy. I want Jeff, though, to talk about the wonderful point that you make in your book, that you are very confident that young people using Facebook, using social media, are in fact protecting their privacy, that they know how to look after themselves out there despite their parents' worries.
We all have to be burned and learn, it's true. We all tell someone on the playground in third grade a secret and find it around the lunch table in an instant. The problem there is not technology, the problem there is gossipy friends or journalists. Dana Boyd is a brilliant researcher in the U.S. who works for Microsoft and now NYU, and she's done a lot of real research with young people. And what she says is that first, the notion of a digital native, someone popularized by Murdoch, by the way, is false. That children do not come out of the womb with a sense of how to tweet and a Facebook page. They have to learn. And to some extent, we have to teach them, but they also have to teach us. My son taught me, for example, that I look at the wall on Facebook as a means to publish, because that's the way I think as a journalist, and he sees it as a way to have conversations in public, which I think is a different way and a new way to do things. But Dana found in research that young people do care about the privacy, do control their privacy, especially if they're going to go to college. They worry about those kinds of things. But they also, importantly, control meaning. And she tells a great story about a young woman whose mother was following her on Facebook, and it was okay with her, it was fine, and the girl was having problems with her boyfriend, and she was very depressed, but she didn't want to put it on Facebook for her mother to see, because her mother would just smother her with sympathy and empathy, and that was the last thing she wanted. But she did want that from her friends. And so she, now I'm going to have a mental block. The song they sing at the end, all of you at once, I want you to tell me the answer. The song they sing at the end of Life of Brian is? It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. And so she put the lyrics to that song on her Facebook page. So her mother thought, oh, lovely, you're having a great day today. All of her friends said, oh, my God, what's happened? So the point that Dana makes is that young people are of course, they're brilliant. We raised them. They're ours. They're from us. And they control the meaning, and they use the tools in appropriate ways. You know, things like young people going on and saying to the shock of their parents that age 14 that they're married on Facebook, but they're doing that for a language that they've created that works for them. Not unlike spycraft, actually. They create languages and characters and things that work. So yes, I think that we should have confidence with some measure of education that young people have this. But I hope dearly that we have my theory of mutually assured humiliation. That you have your embarrassments, I have my embarrassments. If I leave you alone about yours, you'll leave me alone about ours. And perhaps in the end, we actually become more tolerant as a society to realize that we all have our youthful foibles and we all have our ways. And I argue strenuously that I think that publicness, not being forced out of a closet, but choosing to stand out of a closet, was one of the great weapons that gays and lesbians had to beat back the bigots who'd forced them in there. And I think that that's a very important way to look at Obama's announcement 2 weeks ago that being married and gay is not a big deal. Was an important move in the society that I think was made possible by some measure of publicness and the bravery it took. No one should be forced out, but those who choose to stand out. So my hope is that young people, not being digital natives, not really being different, but also understanding the tools of this new world differently, can shape a new world. We have choices facing us. They can shape the new world that's more closed in and worse, or more open and better. And I think the fact that there are 900 million people on Facebook is an indication that we want to connect.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, we're going to end. Will you join me in thanking our panel very much?
And our moderator.
David Marr there presenting You Must Have Something to Hide, recorded at the Sydney Town Hall last night.